You're listening to the Agony Column News Report, featuring interviews, phone interviews, reports from live book events and festivals, and conversations with readers. You can find additional news, interviews, book reviews, and more 5 days a week at the Agony Column website at trashotron.com/agony.
Megan Majumdar's debut novel was a burning. It won a pastel prizes for reasons that you will see when you read her new novel, A Guardian and a Thief. It is simply amazing and a joy to have you with us, Megan.
Thank you so much for having me on today, Rick.
This novel, as I started reading it and began to assess where it was set, in the near future in Kolkata, India, the first thing I thought that came to my mind was an old saying of William Gibson, which is, the future is here, it's just not evenly distributed. And this is true even in the near future you create, where the people are in Kolkata are living largely in what would be our past.
You're so right about that saying, Rick. I haven't heard that before, and that's fascinating. And it makes me think about, so this novel, A Guardian and a Thief, is set in a near future Kolkata, India, which is reeling from the effects of climate change and food scarcity. And in this situation, two families who are trying to protect their own children come into conflict, and you are right that part of what this book explores is who is hit harder by the effects of climate change, who can afford escape or rescue or relief, and who has to really struggle in the face of the climate crisis.
For me, one of the things I loved about this book was the economy of it. It's fairly short, but it is a thrilling read. I mean, it's a page-turning thriller, yet it's written like a very much an artistic novel. It's beautifully written. So talk about creating a thriller that's very tense and page-turning, yet your subjects are artistically rendered. It's a very interesting reading experience for me, because I could hardly stop turning the pages, yet the prose in each page made me want to stop and reflect upon my own situation.
That's very generous of you. Thank you, Rick. And I really appreciate your speaking of this novel as thrilling and the reading experience being propulsive, because that is very much what I tried to do. So as you can tell, this is a novel which deals perhaps with quite serious circumstances, food scarcity, climate crisis, emigration, the lives of these children within these two families. But at the same time, what is very exciting to me as a writer is to create a thrilling and entertaining reading experience. I think the question of how can I have fun while reading something which also gives me big ideas to think about, that question is so energizing to me. I naturally write in a very compressed way. I put a lot of pressure on my sentences and paragraphs to bear weight within the narrative. So yes, I think this novel is 204 pages. It's very short. And that feeling of moving through, I should also say that the clock of this novel is 1 week.
Exactly.
It's one last week where a family has to survive in this city before they emigrate. So there is that clock. You're aware of the days going by. And hopefully this creates an experience where you feel you are on the edge of something meaningful, on the edge of something tremendous. And at the same time, a week also allows enough time to feel that you are in a journey with these families where they see their own selves changing. They see their own morals and beliefs and actions surprising them.
You know, one of the things that I love so much about this novel, and this is only in retrospect at this moment that I realize this, is that it is a beautiful and compact piece of world building. In a sense, and what I think it really helps you is that the situation of your basic core family, the first people we meet, Ma, Dadu, and Mishti, are circumstances that anybody can recognize. They're terrifying and awful. They're extremely poor. They rarely eat. They're in an awful environment. Yet they still have a family and the love of a family holding them together and this hope for a new beginning in America. I think that the family unit in this novel is so beautifully portrayed as having such incredible strength. Both families and Boombas, we meet much later, also really strong and beautiful. The emotions are wonderful. Talk about creating the emotional arcs of these characters.
Thank you for reading so generously and so closely. You know, I never wanted to write a novel which would have a hero and a villain. So I knew that I wanted to write a novel where the two main guardians that we follow, the mother, who's referred to as Ma, she's mother to a toddler. And on the other side, there's a young man of about 20, the villager, who is responsible for his younger brother, who is also a toddler. I knew that I wanted to write these guardians acting from places of love and care. And I was very interested in the question of what happens when our love has manifestations which are vicious and harmful. We tend to think of hope and love as straightforward and noble, but what happens when we are pushed by a crisis to a place of extreme pressure? What happens when we are forced to go against our moral center? What happens when we are forced to steal? Would you steal an orange from another child to feed your own child if it came down to it? So I'm very interested in those questions. And in this book, the characters, they really go from believing themselves to be good people, principled people, they go from that to facing a reality where they have to decide what they will do in order to protect the children that they love. And I wonder if all of us might be surprised by the capacity we contain within us to perform acts which really go against our own beliefs.
You spoke of a word that we often hear in the States, hope. And, you know, it's such a positive word. It has such positive associations. God, it must have been 30 years ago that I read a book by Clive Barker. And one of there's this one phrase in this book that has stuck with me all these years, which was the tyranny of hope. And this book is a monument to the tyranny of hope and the terror and the awful things that can come as a result of that. I think it's so, what you do so well is to combine the sweetness and the joy of family love, of love even between strangers. When you meet a small child and they go, well, that's just the most wonderful being in the world, and you become attached to it, and then you realize that this is the child of the person who will be your greatest enemy. The tyranny of hope is universal, it's oppressive, and I think it's so beautifully rendered in this novel.
I appreciate that so much, Rick. It was really one of the original things that got me into this book is thinking about, well, what is hope? Do we really understand it? And I came to this place because I was reading about climate change. My hometown, Kolkata, India, where this book is set. Kolkata is one of the cities in the world which is most severely affected by climate change. It is a place which has grown hotter. It is predicted to endure more storms and more severe storms. And while I was reading about climate change in this region, I kept encountering these really dire predictions followed by declarations of hope. We must be hopeful. And it got me questioning if we understand what hope is. If we turn to it as a kind of guiding light, does that fully apprehend the muscularity of hope? What do we do when my hope for my family, my children, clashes with the hope of others in the community? What do we do when an expression of hope results in harm to somebody else? What do we do when hope on different scales, hope on the individual scale and on the scale of systems and nations, are incompatible? So I think that there is quite a bit more to hope than we might first understand.
When you were writing this book, did this prose pour off the tip of your pen on in the perfect mode that we find it now? Because there are so many. I went through it and you know, it got to the point where I was highlighting so much of the book. I read it electronically that, you know, it became almost difficult to read.
Oh, I wish that I could write perfect sentences very easily, but there are so many failed drafts buried under this final book. And I suppose the magic of a book is that we read it and we kind of are enthralled by it. We feel the magic of what it is doing to us. But as readers, we don't always see all the work and effort and failure under that book. I worked on A Guardian and a Thief for 6 years. And in the beginning, I had a completely different plot. I had different characters. And I had probably very clumsy sentences. I think part of the work of writing for me is starting out with sentences which feel wobbly and unpersuasive. And then the work is to really ask myself, what am I trying to say here? What is the most precise, most truthful way of expressing what I am seeking to express? And once you start putting that pressure on your sentences, you start looking for a better word, you start looking for a different way to structure a scene, all of that work, which I really love, that work is slow. That is the work of revision. That is the work of telling yourself, this is not good enough yet. I have to make it better.
As I read this book, I really love the characters and the places they lived. And one of the things that you talked a bit, this book is quite a bit, you know, influenced by, you know, your understanding of climate change, what it's doing to where you live. But what I loved about this book was that it didn't wear climate change on its sleeve. It did not point at it and say, see, here's the big bad, and here's the and food scarcity, and say, here's the big bad. We just saw people coping with it on a daily basis, as we all learn to do. And this is, you know, a part of the strength and the great weakness of humanity is that we can learn to live with anything in any way. And that's, I think, a lot about what informs what this book was about.
You're right. A part of the work of this book was imagining a future where people might need cooling garments if they are out in the sun all day. People might agitate for the right to shade from the sun. Imagine people who are perhaps working in fields all day, or even in urban settings, people who are doing food delivery, so they're out on the street all day. People like that might need the right to shade. We might need to carry electrolyte pills with us when we go out instead of only water on a hot day. So I imagined this future. And then, as you're saying, part of the work of the book is not to be didactic or not to say, you know, here is this world, but to say, here are the people in this world. What do you feel for them? What would you do if you were them? So a huge element of the work of writing A Guardian and a Thief was building this near future climate crisis world and then suppressing it a little bit in the book so that the characters, the mother, the grandfather, the older brother, all the minor characters, you know, the artist, the musician, the person who irons clothes for a living, all of these people can become full people and they can really become nodes within the book where a reader might say, I feel something for this person. I understand what it might be like to be this person in this world.
One of the miracles of this book is the intricacy of the narrative and the storytelling. We start out with Ma and Dadu and Mishti, and we eventually meet Boomba and his family. And the way you tell this story, it's so wonderful because, you know, the idea of the guardian and the thief and how there are two in this story and they're kind of like one turns into the other and they turn back and they go back and forth. The intricacy of the storytelling and the story itself is really amazing. So was this, again, I imagine this is like 1,000 pieces of paper, you know, a self-made puzzle out of a blank sheet of paper.
I appreciate that. It was, there's so much work that goes into writing the complexity that I find exciting, and that intricacy, that complexity that you are pointing out, that is so much the goal of my fiction. What I find very energizing is the act of conjuring characters who hold contradictions with themselves, characters who are not just one thing, but are able to be many different things in many different circumstances. And if you think about who you are or the people you know that you find interesting, they probably have all of these aspects to them which are revealed in different circumstances. I thought a lot about Am I my true self in a time of relative comfort and abundance? Or would I be my true self in a situation of crisis and scarcity? Which is really my true self? And that is part of the question that the characters in this book ask themselves. Are they who they are in all of their love and hope and care in the life that they've known so far? Or is it this final week, this extreme week of pressure that shows them who they are?
One of the things that's so lovely about this book is Boomba. What an amazing character, and what a great job you do with him. He, at one point, kind of falls in love with Ma's granddaughter, who's a toddler, Mishti, and goes on an adventure with her, which for us is just like a astonishingly well imagined and beautiful and terrifying. Talk about taking a character and, just like slowly turning that screw. Usually, when you turn the screw, the character goes bad, but this is like a character who experiences joy and love, and you think, wow, it's certainly a kind of an astonishing narrative turn and a beautiful piece of writing.
There is a scene in the book, the scene that you're referring to, where this young villager by the name of Boomba goes to a feast hosted by a billionaire in the city. And he takes a child with him. And in that scene, I wanted to show how this character of Boomba is a very complicated guy. He has the capacity to feel warmth and affection. He goes to the feast initially thinking, well, I'm just going to take food off this kid's plate and save it for myself. But he sees her eating. And he helps her. He helps her with the fish bones and he helps her to peel fruit. And there is something in him which is able to feel care and kindness for a child. There is nothing in him which is cruel in that moment. But there are other moments in the book where he is cruel, where he is incredibly selfish. So I'm glad that the complexity of that character came through for you on the page.
One of the things I thought that you did really well was to give us three generations living in one house with Daru, his grown daughter Ma, and her toddler Mishti. Talk about that decision, which, as a writer, I mean, it, on one hand, it offers the utility of, showing through three different lenses, but also, I mean, what a complex juggling now you set up for yourself.
The three generations really allowed me an opportunity to look at the city in different ways. The child, Mishti, is, of course, the person who holds the center of all the hope in this book. It is for her and for her future that these astonishing decisions are made by the adults in the book. The character of Ma, the mother, she is very relieved to be leaving the city. Departure is exciting for her because while she has a lot of affection for the city, it is also a city in which she found it very hard to be a young girl. And Dadu is probably the character in the book who feels the most sorrow at the prospect of emigrating. For him, the city is a peerless place of laughter and conversation and community and connection and help. And he knows that he will never again find those relationships. They are all supposed to move to Michigan, so he knows that he will never again find those relationships in Michigan, nor will he ever again be able to be the person that he is in this hometown. So he will leave behind an essential part of himself. And by looking at these generations and their views of this city, I hoped to think through what it means for an immigrant to move far away from home. I think many immigrants will recognize this feeling of holding two true things in mind. And one is that you are so proud of your achievements. You are so joyful at having built a new life in a new place. And at the same time, you are aware of such grief because you left behind your home, your family, the place where you could have had this other life.
In a sense, I was just thinking now that, based on what you were saying, that this is a book where nostalgia for an unfortunate past plays a big part, in that you will look back at your past, and when you were there, you're thinking, boy, this is hard and unpleasant. But when your past, when it is in the past, you can think, I dealt with that. I lived through that. Now, here I am. So, talk about using nostalgia as a for an unfortunate past as a driving force for the narrative, which is like it ramps the tension up to, you know, it's really, in a sense, this book is somewhat terrifying.
You're right that memory and nostalgia have so much to do with the reality of the characters here. And I wonder now how much of that comes from my own nostalgia for my hometown. I grew up in Kolkata and I now live in New York. And I have been living in this country for half my life. So I wonder about the city that I visit in my fiction, which is the city of my childhood. And now it is a city of the past. Those places no longer exist in exactly the forms that I remember them. The city is, of course, always changing. And I wonder about the project of fiction allowing me my own nostalgia and then allowing me space to translate that nostalgia into the memories of these characters.
There's a passage in this book that I think is I haven't read anything quite as remarkable since I read the novel of Gordon Guest by Mervyn Peake, where we get inside the mind of a very old man and see his thoughts in an important moment in his life. It's beautifully written. It's a little bit sneaky what you're doing. So the question I have for you is, did you know where this is going to end up when you start writing that part and say, okay, I've got to go take this tack? Or did you take this tack and realize that it could only end up one place?
The passage that you are referring to, where the grandfather looks back upon his life, it was actually surprisingly one of the earliest sections that I wrote in the book. And for a long time, I didn't quite know where it would belong. But something about that passage felt so vital and life-giving and moving to me. I knew that the book needed this moment of being very close to the grandfather, especially, I think, to be able to see the grandfather not just in his role in the book as a protector, as somebody who is doing everything he can to save his grandchild, but to see him for who he has been, to see him as a boy and as a young man and as somebody who loves art and enjoys the jokes that people make on the street that he overhears. It felt really essential to show readers, look, here is who this person is.
Boomba's family is really fascinating. This is the young man. We meet him in person about halfway through the book. Could you talk about the decision to hold back on introducing him and not right at first? It was a really wise decision, and it made the book more powerful as the story unfolded. And I think this is part of your fascinating narrative strategy to show us one part gets into one life and then into another, and then as you weave them together. So talk about Boomba. How early did you discover him, and how did you decide to weave him into the story in the way in which you wove him into the story?
For a while, I was writing only the character of Ma, the mother, and I had this idea of a thief who would come into the house and take something really important. And I had this idea of a collision between the lives of the thief and of Ma. But it took me quite a while to understand that this thief would need to be a full person of his own. Otherwise, I would be stuck with a character that a reader relates to and sees as a good and decent person, which is Ma. And then the reader might think, oh, it's a thief. Simply by introducing this character as a thief, you take away that he is the villain. He's doing something wrong. We do not want to connect with him. And I knew that that felt false. That did not feel true. So that's when I started thinking about, who is this thief? What are his motivations for coming into the city? What are his motivations for stealing, and in what really surprising ways might he be close to the person who is introduced as the guardian of the title?
As I read the book, there are so many parts that I thought were so memorably well written. And here's one piece where he said, with Dadu, everything beautiful and everything useful about the city could be found in these relationships of dependence with one's barber, one's rickshaw driver, one's editor, one's neighbor. How had Dadu forgotten that? And I think that these kind of observations are so beautifully written into the manuscript. Could you talk about, creating these kind of they're almost like little platforms where the reader's going to just stop and think about their life. And that's one of the things that this novel does very well, is it puts you so firmly in the characters' lives that you step back to your own life and go, wow, what the heck would I do? And what the heck am I doing?
I love the idea of these platforms, these moments within the book where a reader can pause and reflect and bring their own life to bear on how they are thinking about a character or a scene. The moment that you mentioned where Dadu talks about the relationships of dependence in the city, it felt to me so meaningful to bring that into the book, because one of the things that I love about Kolkata is that relationships matter, even very thin relationships, you know, your relationship with your cousins, neighbors, one-time teachers, friend, or, you know, however the relationship may unfold, even those thin relationships are relationships, and people take being asked for help and needing help very seriously, the way in which people make claims on other people's time. Can you do this for me? Can you bring this for me? I think those requests and claims activate relationships. They remind us we need each other. And there is something so beautiful in even thin relationships having those truths at their core. We need each other. And moments of reflection like that, you know, they are moments where I am thinking through the life of this city. I am thinking through what is it like to be this character in this place? What might be remarkable to them? What might they think about?
You talk about Kolkata quite a bit, and this is, you know, you lived there before you moved to New York. And, you know, as you were saying that, I was thinking, well, depending on where you are in New York, the difference between New York and Kolkata might be negligible. and I think that, for me at least, one of the things I loved about this book, though we understand it to be set in the future, it feels like the present to us. And I think that the characters are so familiar with their own current lives that the idea of a past or a future is relevant to them. And I think that the relevancy of the present and the power of every single second you live is one of the things that vitally informs this book and makes it so beautiful and also so page-turningly terrifying.
It's, you know, the matter of the future and the present. And I'm going back to that beautiful quote you shared a while ago about the uneven distribution of the future. It is, you know, as true in any big city like New York and probably San Francisco as it is in Kolkata. I think you're right about the similarity of New York and Kolkata. There is similar energy, similar ambition, similar encounter with all different kinds of people on public transport and on the streets. And I think that brushing up against people of different means and different backgrounds and hearing different languages when you are on a bus or on the subway, encountering different kinds of food, different kinds of art, those encounters are so important for forming a sense of community and for forming a sense of who we are within that community.
You made a deliberate decision to set this book in a future that is that you managed to make for the reader indistinguishable from the present. I mean, it's hot here. There are lots of places where there's food in scarcity. Immigration is a big topic in this book, although it's outside its scope. Talk about the using the future as a device, you know, to frame a setting that you want to be indistinguishable from the present.
The continuity of present and future is very interesting to me. What of our predictions will turn out to be incorrect? What will...
Most of them.
Most of them. What will be real, which we are not thinking of at all? And you're right that so much of my fiction is nourished by reading the news, paying attention to what is happening in our present reality, and thinking about, well, what can fiction add to the conversation which is not necessarily captured by the news? For example, thinking about food scarcity and how agriculture will change, which I'm sure this is something that many people in California are thinking about. How will agriculture change in the coming decades with changing weather patterns? So that's something that I was reading about in books by researchers, and it got me thinking about, well, how will that change the texture of what it means to have a meal with your family? If you go to the market and instead of buying cauliflower and eggs, you have to buy insect protein. You have to buy crickets processed into flour and turned into some kind of edible protein. What is that going to do to the notion of having, let's say, a Sunday lunch with your family? So those emotional textures are where fiction can help us approach what we really mean when we talk about the future and when we talk about changes.
Your previous book was set in the present. This one set a bit in the future. One of the things I like about speculative fiction and is that it allows you to externalize conflicts that otherwise might remain internal. In other words, you can use the circumstances, the food scarcity, the heat, the income inequality between the characters that we meet in your book, and the billionaire, which is just like kind of like stunning. It's like, you know, going to the moon. It's like visiting when Boomba and his companion visit the what they call the hexagon. It's like he's going to the moon. It's so unusual. So talk about using the power and the of imagination that speculative fiction allows you to take, you know, what are internal debates about, you know, that might occur inside a person and externalizing them as plot points.
That's a great question. Speculative fiction, you know, one fascinating thing is that writing this novel did give me the space to consider what the lived experience of living through climate crisis might be. And you're right that it also allowed me to delve deep into these characters' interior lives and force them to ask the questions of, what will I do when my love for my child forces me to abandon my moral self? What will I do when this great battle of love and ethical self becomes impossible to turn away from. That is the whole question of the book, you know, is what will we do when our love compels us to look at who we really are and what we are truly capable of? And perhaps this near future setting allowed me to put more pressure on the characters than I would have been able to.
As I was reading this book and seeing these portraits of hunger, I apologize, I couldn't help but think of a very famous, and I think back now, the sort of a speculative essay written by Jonathan Swift, A Modest Proposal, which was his idea that the Irish could get out of the potato famine by serving up their children. And I think that, you know, there's a bit of that happening in the background of your book, not the cannibalism so much, but the conflict between the direness of actual circumstances and the desire of your hope to help for a better life for your family, for those around you, but where all of a sudden, nope, this is where we're drawing the limits. These people are no longer around us, and they can go ahead with this modest proposal.
I can only imagine, I haven't read that, but I can only imagine that it is meant to point out the absurdity of being in a crisis like that and expecting people to come up with solutions which are propelled by individual will and motivation. And I can only imagine that it is meant perhaps in part to encourage us to look at the systems which put us in this situation, right? What are the systems which force ordinary people to live through a crisis like this? And it is very much part of what the novel can do, which is why I find the form of the novel so exciting, is it can hold the scale of systems and nations and decisions made at those levels, along with decisions made in the life of a person. A novel can allow us to see and really journey along these scales. What does climate change mean in the life of a two-year-old? What does climate change mean in the life of her mother? And also, what does climate change mean for a billionaire for whom it is a crisis with perhaps edges of possibility for future profit, future gain, future political benefit?
Also, as I read this book, and I think this is deliberate on your part, is that as we read this book and are plunged so perfectly into the day-to-day existence of Dadu and Ma and Mishti and Boomba, it's impossible not to, like, when you put the book down for a second, which is difficult to look, it's very difficult not to look around your own life and think, oh my God, what are all the forces that are affecting me, making me do things that I don't know that I'm doing or don't care about doing, that it's just, you know, me like being hurled by the current of my life down the riverbed, and where will I end up? Oops, I'm on the edge of Niagara Falls.
Yes, I think that interplay of larger forces, feeling like we are to some degree powerless in the systems and societies that we live in, and also recognizing that we do still have individual will, we do still have the ability to make choices. That interplay is a fascinating place for fiction. It's the place where we can think about what choices will we make within the limitations that we acknowledge.
Have you started a new novel?
I have. I'm working very slowly on it.
I will look forward to reading it no matter where and when it was set, because I think for me, the real power of this novel was just to find myself so immersed in lives that were so like mine and unlike mine. And that new novel by Megha Majumdar is A Guardian and a Thief. Thank you for joining me, Megha.
Thank you so much for having me, Rick.
You're listening to the Agony Column News Report, featuring interviews, phone interviews, reports from live book events and festivals, and conversations with readers. You can find additional news, interviews, book reviews, and more 5 days a week at the Agony Column website at trashotron.com/agony.